Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, a program dedicated to protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, and to the glory of God and His kingdom. It is a special pleasure to be able to welcome to our microphones and camera Representative Scott Perry of Pennsylvania. He is a retired Army combat veteran and Brigadier General who is now the chairman of the House Freedom Caucus, an organization that's made up of the most principled conservatives in the United States Congress. We're always delighted to catch up with him. Welcome back, Congressman, to Securing America.
It's great to be with you, Frank. Thanks for the opportunity.
I've got so much I want to talk to you about, and we've got so little time. Let me jump right into the question of Ukraine. There is a lot of concern in conservative circles, among others, that what's happening there really isn't our problem. It's somebody else's, the Europeans, or just the Ukrainians, and that we really should just simply stay out of it. What is your take on, well, what's actually taking place there and whether it is, in fact, something we should be engaged in some fashion?
Well, thanks for asking the question, Frank. And America has to be engaged, but it's how America has to be engaged, I think, is the real thing. And of course, what's going on there? Look, I think there's two trains of thought. I kind of reject one and more espouse the other. There's one that Vladimir Putin is paranoid about NATO. And so because he doesn't want NATO countries on his border, he's invading Ukraine to expel any potential, I guess, occupation, so to speak, or any alliance with NATO right on his border. I think that's quite honestly patently absurd. NATO, first of all, is a defensive organization. Second of all, in your lifetime and in my lifetime, has never done anything meaningful regarding the Soviet Union or Russia. So I think that's a straw man. I think the larger case can be made with legitimacy that this is Vladimir Putin wishing and seeking and actually reconstituting or taking further steps to reconstitute the Soviet Union, the former Soviet Union. I think that's what this is about. Georgia, Chechnya fall into the realm of this, certainly Crimea. And the rest of the Ukraine is just the most recent excursion. So that's, I think, what's happening. What can be done about it? Look, we don't want to be in World War III, but I think we have to take Vladimir Putin seriously. I think he's challenging the Biden administration. As you can see right now, most people don't, I think, concern themselves with international issues. They just figure it doesn't really affect them. And that's what international people do and whatever. But it's affecting them greatly now, and it's about to affect them much, much more. And I don't know that most people realize it, but I think that Vladimir Putin has assessed that Joe Biden is feckless, he's weak, he's infirm, he's clueless, he's you name it. And this is Putin's opportunity to gobble up some more territory and further his goals. And there's not going to be any consequence for it, or there's going to be very little consequence for it. And I think that that's what we're seeing right now.
Let me just ask you one more question before we get into what we should do about it, Congressman. And that is, there are those who say, look, Putin is our natural ally. We should not be trying to prevent him from doing what he wishes to do in Ukraine or punish him, certainly. And yet we are. The evident effort of the Biden administration to sort of deflect attention, I think, from its own shortcomings to this particular crisis feeds into some of that sentiment. You're a retired brigadier general in the United States Army. You've spent time actually in combat. You know a lot more about these things than I think the vast majority of certainly your colleagues in Congress and most of the rest of us, for that matter. Where do you come down on this question of whether or not we should be working to try to defeat Vladimir Putin in this act of unprovoked aggression against Ukraine?
Well, some, you cut out there a little bit, Frank, but I think I get the gist of the question. Russia is not any way a strategic ally. They are not any way a strategic competitor. I know we've been told that since the end of the Cold War. Russia is the USSR formally constituted. They are the enemy of the United States economically, militarily, informationally, diplomatically. That's what they consider us to be. And although that they have an economy about the size of Italy, they have an overpowered military and an overpowering will. And of course, they are nuclear armed. And so that's of great concern, as it should be. You know, like I said, we don't want to get into a shooting war with Russia. So no-fly zones are an interesting discussion, but I think a practicality. First of all, I don't think most of the strikes happening in Ukraine are coming from the air. And I've asked that question, particularly I haven't gotten great answers on it from a percentage standpoint. But as you know, Frank, the Russian military is foundationed and is cemented in its or its foundation is its artillery. They are known for massive artillery barrages to prep the battlefield. It is the king of their battle. That's what they lead with, and it's what they do very, very well. So to me, without an airfield in Ukraine, yes, with devastating effect is correct. And there are no airfields in Ukraine left that haven't been cratered, that the Russians aren't already using. So I'm not sure where you fly these MiGs or any other aircraft from Ukraine to defend yourself or attack the enemy. I don't know where you take off from. So the only answer is to take off from a neighboring country. And then, of course, you're involved that way. Now, let's face it. The United States and and NATO and the EU are involved already. And so, you know, you might say, well, we're already in for a penny. We might as well be in for a pound. If we can deter Vladimir Putin without being in for a pound and getting ourselves into World War III and sending our bodies, I think that's the answer. And quite honestly, this is a circumstance that we are way, way late to the game to, but it's not too late to start on the right road. And that right road is completely isolating Russia diplomatically, economically, and informationally. So they use hybrid warfare, so everything's on the table. It's somewhat like unrestricted warfare, but they are masters at cyber, and we need to be in that space. But the other space that we really need to be in, Frank, is the economic space. They need to be isolated completely economically, so they need to be removed from the World Trade Organization. Exports and imports to and from Russia should essentially end at the hand of the World Trade Organization, and we have to use whatever leverage we have there. From the financial circumstance, the United States is the premier financial influencer on the planet, and we don't use that to any effect, really, in this regard. Certainly, Vladimir Putin, who has committed war crimes and crimes against humanity, he should have zero access to anything that we can affect as the world financial market leader. And then finally, there's absolutely no reason that Vladimir Putin or Russia should be on the United Nations Security Council. Most people don't know this, but Russia called for an emergency meeting of the Security Council regarding their own invasion of Ukraine. It's just patently absurd. Those are the things that's a simple solution where we need to start. They need to be treated like what they are, which is a third world despotic regime. And unfortunately, while we have no quarrel with the people of Russia, we do with their leader. And he just can't be allowed to continue to gobble up territory and threaten the world and extort the world through his use of fossil fuels. And I just remind people, there's no war in Ukraine or in Western Europe over solar panels and windmills. This is all over oil and gas. And this is what we get for following Biden and the left who worship at the altar of the Green New Deal. This is exactly what they're getting, and it's coming to us unless we start reversing course, seeing the reality of the world as it is, not the reality of the world that we wish existed.
So you've described, I think, very persuasively that we actually do have an interest in all of this and that we must help the Ukrainians and our European allies in resisting what Putin is doing. You've enumerated a number of steps that could be taken. I'm not sure that getting the Russians off the Security Council is an option, but I'm told there is an Article 42 provision that might allow the UN to become engaged in all of this, notwithstanding the Russians' opposition, if they've been engaged, as they clearly have in this case, with crimes against humanity. But I guess the key piece that I hear you talking about, Congressman Scott Perry, and why I think, you know, you bring so much to this topic and more generally to the leadership void in Congress, is we must make sure that Putin does not succeed in destroying Ukraine. Congressman, we're going to take a short break. We're going to be right back with more with Congressman Scott Perry right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. There's much talk of a great reset favored by global capitalists, more or less unapologetically admiring of the efficiency of the Chinese Communist Party. The day's headlines demonstrate that what is needed instead is a freedom reset. A CCP virus-justified lockdown of China's key manufacturing hub in Shenzhen underscores the dangerous folly of supply chain dependencies in the name of engagement with the People's Republic. Deep sell-offs of Chinese stocks over concerns about, among other things, capricious government regulations and interference is a warning against U.S. investments in them. And the prospect that Xi Jinping will help bail out his ally, Vladimir Putin, suggests worse is to come. That's especially so if U.S. states, including Republican-run ones, introduce China's odious social credit system for surveilling and controlling their people in the guise of digital health cards. Join us in opposing them at StopVaxPassports.org. This is Frank Gaffney.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, and I'm thrilled to say we're continuing this conversation with one of the great leaders in the United States Congress. His name is Scott Perry. He represents the people of the 10th District of Pennsylvania and is the chairman of the incredibly important House Freedom Caucus. He brings to bear the experience of an actual combat veteran of the United States Army, a brigadier general now retired from its National Guard. And we're delighted always to have a chance to catch up with him on that, well, matters of great importance to our world. And I'd like to turn to another one, Congressman. The Biden administration seems absolutely determined to conclude a deal with Iran. No matter how ignominious is the treatment that they've been receiving at the hands of the mullahs, how terrible the terms are in terms of our national interests, and how, well, completely improbable is the idea that we're actually going to have some new piece of paper prevent the Iranians from realizing their longstanding objective to get the most dangerous weapons in the world, namely nuclear arms. What's your take on what's happening and whether Congress is going to be able and or willing to interpose objections to what seems to be an absolutely harebrained idea?
Well, Frank, thanks so much for the question. I don't know. Unfortunately, people are so busy in your lives, they don't probably watch this happening. But we're literally told they're very close to a deal. And when I say they, I'm talking the United States and Iran. So let's break this down. I would break it down into three pieces this way. First of all, President Biden is incompetent and he's unqualified to make any such agreement. Number two, Iran should not be trusted to abide by any such agreement based on their past. And then number three, that any such agreement should be in the form of a treaty, not some agreement that is non-binding, but somehow yet the America binds itself to and Iran doesn't bother following. So let's start with number one. President Biden is not qualified or competent to make this agreement. Your listeners, your watchers, your readers all need to know that, first of all, America is not negotiating. It's actually the Russians negotiating on our behalf because Iran, who calls us the... Well, that's exactly right. While at this moment, Russia is invading Ukraine, while Russia also supports Iran militarily, they're negotiating allegedly on our behalf. And I just wonder, so we have two terrorist nations negotiating with each other, and we're supposed to think that we're going to get something good out of it. So that's number one. Biden's just completely incompetent in this. We saw the withdrawal from Afghanistan. We saw how he's actually supported Iran with the lifting of sanctions and literally considering paying Iran billions of dollars and absolving the members of the IRGC, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, or the Quds Force, of their crimes against humanity, and certainly their crimes on the battlefield against American citizens in Iraq and Afghanistan, and then of course their spread of terrorism around the globe, whether it's through the Houthis or Hezbollah or Hamas. And so Joe Biden's not qualified. So that's number one. Number two, Iran. You can't trust them. They never abided by the first agreement. And by the way, even the Obama administration said that that was a non-binding agreement, neither country actually signed it. And but even so, Iran never abided by it. They were still enriching at Fordow, which was prohibited for 15 years. They were still, enriching above 2-3%. 2-3% is the only thing that is needed for the use of peaceful power production. And recently reported and continually reported Iran enriching at 60%, which is bordering on weapons grade. We all know that's exactly what they're intending on doing, is creating a nuclear weapon, which then they will deliver with their ballistic missile system that they've been allowed under the last agreement to just continue perfecting. So Iran can't be trusted. Frank, for the love of my goodness, they have sent or solicited assassins in the United States of America to kill John Bolton, Ambassador Bolton, National Security Advisor Bolton, and Secretary of State Pompeo. So these are the people we're going to trust. That's now. That's happened. Speaking of now, Frank, Iran just launched missiles, 12 missiles out of Iran into Iraq towards our consulate in Erbil. And we said nothing. Yep. The Biden administration has said nothing while the negotiations are going on. That's like trying to have a negotiation with a person that's holding you down, got their arm around your neck and is punching you in the face, and you're trying to negotiate with them. And then finally, this absolutely must be a treaty. Article 2 of the Constitution states that while the president can negotiate, the legislature must ratify by supermajority. The reason they don't want to do that, the reason the Biden administration doesn't want to do that, is because they know it will never pass, because the American people see everything we've talked about and don't want any of this. And then finally, Frank, and just to add insult to injury, not only is Russia involved in the negotiation and helping Iran, but so is China. As a matter of fact, those missiles that landed in Erbil next to our consulate, they got advice and technical expertise from China to make them. China's involved completely with Iran. As a matter of fact, the premier has been invited to Iran to meet with the mullahs. So this has strong connections to the worst of the worst in the world, and we absolutely can't be trusting any of this to go on. So Congress absolutely must speak with a very loud voice.
I couldn't agree with you more. I hope they will, and I hope that it will be dispositive. At the very least, they must object to this process, as you say. And Biden's predecessor, Barack Obama, got away with essentially blowing it past Congress. I hope that won't happen in this case, because it's an even worse deal, and it's even less likely to stop the Iranian ambitions. Let me just turn very quickly. You mentioned China there at the end, Congressman Scott Perry. We are looking at China making very little secret that it intends to act aggressively in its own right against Taiwan, possibly against India, perhaps against both for that matter. Do you think that their takeaway from what they've seen so far with respect to Putin and his, well, murderous invasion of Ukraine is likely to translate into more of an incentive to act aggressively against Taiwan? Or do you think that they're actually now likely to pull back from the brink in their own right?
I think that that China is absolutely watching what happens in Ukraine. Now, they might be assessing that the Russian army isn't everything it's meant to be or was purported to be, and they might feel themselves in a very good position as their new alliance with Russia. Russia showcasing its inability to move quickly through a nation state of Ukraine that should have really not been much of an obstacle for a first-class world army. That having been said, what they're really watching is the response from the West, and of course, the United States in particular are now flying fighters into Taiwan's airspace and daring anybody to do anything about it. And of course, nothing's being done about it. And of course, Frank, you know, recently they issued a statement that basically said anybody that thinks they're going to help Taiwan militarily is going to be considered an act of aggression against China. And of course, as you know, we do help Taiwan militarily. We have forces stationed close by. We sell them arms and equipment and advise them on expertise. And we do have a sorts of a gentleman agreement that we're not going to allow China to run the Taiwan Straits and subsume Taiwan. So I think this is a very critical, pivotal time. We would certainly lose a lot by allowing China to just walk across the doorstep of Taiwan and take it over. But they're watching Russia right now and a very, very tepid response regarding Ukraine. And I think that does definitely inform President Xi. You know, peace was breaking all out around the world under Trump, but now look at the chaos.
We're out of time, Congressman. I couldn't agree with you more on that last point. I think we've got more than a gentleman's agreement to try to defend the Taiwanese. I hope that we will be indicating lessons learned from the Ukraine experience, that we've got to deter the Russians and the Chinese now, by especially making sure the Russians don't get away with murder. Thank you, Congressman. Come back to us again soon, if you will. Next up, we're going to talk about the home front with one of the great political operatives, George Raisler, right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. George Raisler is literally a brilliant political operative with decades of experience in over 300 campaigns at every level. These days, he is the managing editor of a superb publication, Richard Viguerie's Conservative HQ, which you can find at conservativehq.com. George, it's good to have you with us. Welcome back to Securing America.
Thanks for having me back, Frank.
You've been reporting on a whole host of subjects about basically the home front, and I'm anxious to take stock with you on several different aspects of it, George. Maybe just starting with the proposition that I think a lot of people still find unimaginable, and that is that we do have enemies within this country. One of the most prominent of them, and a guy who seems to be doing a lot to embolden and empower the others, is a fellow by the name of George Soros. Talk a little bit about your insights into his activities and the problems that they constitute for the rest of us.
Oh, you mean the guy I refer to as Nazi collaborator, George Soros?
Well, I think that's one description that's apt, yes.
Yeah. Well, Soros has accumulated a fund of over $15 billion, that's billion with a B, dollars, to put into not just typical Democrat causes, but far left, communist causes, everything from sanctuary cities to opening our borders, and perhaps most importantly, training revolutionary cadres, is funded by Soros. And he's by far the biggest funder of the things that are destroying America, literally billions of dollars every election cycle into these causes. And I suspect, although, you know, I couldn't prove it sitting here today, that almost every one of the bad actors leading these organizations that are undermining America is or has been on the payroll of George Soros at one time.
Let me ask you about two that we have been hearing a lot about lately. George Soros's funding for prosecutors, district attorneys, and the like, on the one hand, and secretaries of state across the country as well, George. And it seems as though these are two strategically vectored attacks on sort of cornerstones of our republic. On the one hand, the rule of law, and the other, the election integrity that our system of government depends upon.
Yeah,
talk absolutely. A little bit about what he's up to in those regards and the damage that's being done as a result.
Well, there are dozens of prosecutors across the country and candidates for elected prosecutor who are pursuing these far left jailbreak policies that have been, you know, funded and trained by Soros. San Francisco, Cheesa Bowden is just, you know, one, but suburban D.C., even, you know, rural Louisiana have prosecutors that have been funded by Soros. And these are the guys behind these no bail release policies that are turning, you know, our cities into urban wastelands inhabited by feral humans, you know, something right out of Clockwork Orange.
No, it really is, George. And it's not just that they're, you know, giving people, you know, get out of jail free cards. It's that they're simply refusing to prosecute a whole host of crimes. And again, the lawlessness that is afflicting our cities, among other places, is extremely insidious. How about the election integrity piece? We've certainly seen in election 2020 what secretaries of state, who in some cases were Soros elected, I suppose, or in others just, you know, sort of falling in line with their willingness to look the other way at election fraud. How serious is his contribution to that problem, do you think?
Well, it's huge. And again, you know, where this is worst is at the local county level, or, you know, where, you know, these guys don't put on huge campaigns. They're relatively obscure, but they're the ones that are the initial vote counters. And if Soros dumps $500,000 into a local election official's campaign, they're going to win. And they're going to approve drop boxes, unsupervised drop boxes. They're going to mail unsolicited absentee ballots to everybody who's gotten a driver's license in that county, and so on and so on. And it, you know, is just basically they run elections on the assumption that fraud helps them.
Right. And indeed, it seems it does, at least on certain occasions. George, let me switch gears because in terms of elections, one of that is coming up, obviously, is the congressional midterms. You've done a recent profile on Senator Rick Scott of Florida, who I believe is chairing the Senate election, you know, sort of program for Republicans. Yeah. Talk about a platform that he's come forward with, much to the consternation and I gather the upset of the Senate's top Republican, Mitch McConnell.
Yeah, well, the title of the article was something to the effect of Rick Scott proves that Mitch McConnell is a phony. Mm. But essentially, Scott came up with the 11-point platform, if you will, which is all great stuff. It probably, you know, polls at 80% or better with Republicans and independents. It's, you know, energy,
Republicans
security.
And independents. That's
and independents, rather impressive. Yeah. Yeah. But it's, you know, it's all solid, conservative, mainstream type of stuff that, you know, if you read out those 11 points that you're, you know, morning coffee clutch at any diner in America, everybody would start clapping. Mm. Well, McConnell doesn't want to get pinned down to doing anything.
Right.
and he literally said so. And so
in terms of, you know, contract with America or promises for what you will get if you mm-hmm. return the Senate to Republican control, Scott is offering some specifics. McConnell is saying, we want to run on, I guess, basically a platform that we're not as bad as the other guys. Is that kind of what
well,
it comes
yeah.
down?
Well, yeah. And what they don't want after the election is if they do get the majority, they don't want anybody to come up and say, hey, wait a minute, this is what you promised to do.
Right.
Because, you know, they will revert to being Democrats light if they don't have
at best
an agenda that they've committed to.
Yeah.
And you
that's
know,
the so establishment, the monoparty, I think they call it uniparty.
The uniparty. Yeah.
Right. So if you're a conservative, you'll not only like what Rick Scott is offering, but you'll be horrified, I suppose, by what is on offer otherwise. And I hope that that will inform decisions this fall. Let me ask you, if I can, about one other idea that is now being brooded by Joe Biden aggressively. And that is, you know, all of this inflation stuff, or at least the very substantial contributor to it, that is the increased costs of gas, gasoline specifically, is actually just Vladimir Putin's fault. And George Raceley, I think you take a different view of that, but why would he be trying to get away with blaming Putin for what might not actually be entirely his doing?
Well, because, you know, it's literally Joe Biden's fault and the mm-hmm. Democrats' fault. And it's, you know, even a one-armed economist could prove and demonstrate that that's the case. I mean, inflation's gone up every month he's been president. Gas prices have gone up every month he's been president. And these are
and
policy.
That's because he started out as president doing a wrecking operation, as I call
yeah.
it, on our energy security, no?
Absolutely. I mean, these are all policy price increases. You know, if you reduce our ability to produce oil and gasoline and natural gas here at home, then those increases show up not just at the pump for commuters, they show up for truck drivers who are hauling your produce.
Right.
They show up for plastic manufacturers that are using natural gas as a feedstock. They show up in the cost of fertilizer.
Right.
And so there's a inflationary cycle here that is totally policy driven. It's not that demand has significantly increased. It's that policy driven supply reductions have driven up the prices, and those prices, particularly of energy, flow through the entire economy.
They do indeed. And to the extent that they're damaging the entire economy, George Raceley, you can understand why Biden would want to deflect blame, but is he likely to be able to get away with it quickly?
No, I don't think so. I mean, Rasmussen did a recent poll that showed that, you know, a substantial majority of Americans blame Biden's, you know, policies for inflation. And so, you know, contrary to what Democrats think, Americans aren't stupid. They occasionally do dumb stuff like letting Biden get away with stealing the election. But, you know, they're not stupid. They understand economics and they understand, you know, these are policy driven inflation numbers.
Right. But this is why it's so vital that they have information that they can rely on. And it's something that you provide at conservativehq.com. Scott, I'm so pleased to have you with us, George Raceley, talking about Senator Scott, among other things. Come back to us again soon with updates, if you would. Next up, we're going to speak with Ambassador Pete Hoekstra about Europe, lessons learned, what's coming next, right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back, and a special welcome to our next guest, one of our favorites. His name is Congressman Pete Hoekstra, also known as Ambassador Pete Hoekstra. He has served his country with great distinction in a variety of capacities, notably as a member of Congress, of course, as chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, and also as our country's representative to the Netherlands under the Trump administration. He is these days the chairman of the Center for Security Policy's Board of Advisors, which I'm delighted about, and always, as I said, very welcome here. Thank you very much, Mr. Ambassador, for joining us.
It's great to be with you, Frank. Thank you.
I want to start by asking you about an experience that you had not so long ago when you were in The Hague, trying to persuade, well, your host government most immediately, but also to support broader efforts being made by President Trump at the time to get the Europeans to take seriously their national security commitments and their obligations as members of NATO to make certain defense expenditures. Very hard sledding in the day, wasn't it? And how would you say it seems to contrast, particularly with the attitude at the moment, after the Europeans, I guess, have been, as they say, mugged by reality?
Well, Frank, you know, Donald Trump and the Trump administration wanted to highlight to the Europeans the threat from Russia. There were two major things that they were focused on. They were focused on strengthening NATO by requesting every country to meet the commitment that they made in 2014 to spend 2% of their GDP on national security, on defense spending. The Dutch were, depending on who counted on what day, they were around 1.3%. So, you know, about 33% below the target that we wanted them to be at and where they had committed to go. And you get there and they say, well, Pete, you know, we've got a coalition government. We've got four different parties in the coalition. We can't open up the agreement. You know, we'll get to more defense spending sometime in the future.
Trust us.
They had an election a year ago. They put together a new coalition government. They said, well, we're going to attempt to get to the median of NATO government spending, which is about 1.5%. So now you go back and you see what's happening, and I track what's happening. They're saying, well, we're even with what's going on in Russia, we have this coalition government again. We have an agreement. We've committed to get to 1.5%. We can't reopen the agreement, so we're not moving to 2%. So the Dutch actually are not moving at all as a result of the events in Ukraine. The other big program or project of emphasis was Nord Stream 2. Everybody talks about this as being a German project. But the Dutch were very involved in this project. They helped finance it. The Dutch are great on the water. They're also great under the water. Their technology helped construct the pipeline. And, you know, the president talked about putting sanctions on the companies and the banks that were financing this or working on the construction. You know, the Dutch resisted, and, you know, we never really moved fully ahead, but, you know, the Dutch said, you know, Nord Stream is purely an economic issue. It is not a national security issue.
Wow. Pete, let me just ask you, because this stands in pretty stark contrast to what we've seen out of the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz lately. I think it was the 27th of February, he sort of announced that his government had been making mistakes on both of these scores, really, both the defense spending allocations and most especially on Nord Stream 2 and the idea that they could safely become even more dependent, as the Dutch are as well, on Russian gas imports through that first Nord Stream pipeline and prospectively through the second one. Do you see the Dutch, or for that matter, Europe more broadly, swinging at anchor on these issues?
I'm skeptical. All right. The you know, right now in the heat of a war in Ukraine, a number of the countries in Europe are saying the right thing. All right, but they're not. I question whether they're really committed. The Dutch may be the most honest here, saying we're not going to increase defense spending. And I doubt whether they'll ever take a look, a second look at Nord Stream 2.
And that's their position, even after their German partners have professed reconsideration of both.
Right. Wow. You know, my. Let's see once where we are in 6 or 9 months. You know, I'm skeptical. I think there's a real opportunity that in 6 to 9 months, we're going to see them still pumping gas, or they're going to start pumping gas through Nord Stream 2. The Germans have just made a decision that, you know, reversed the decision. The implication was that they were going to open the reopen three nuclear plants that were scheduled for shutdown. It looks like that's not going to happen. Well, if you don't reopen three nuclear plants, you're going to need to get energy from somewhere. And the only immediate place for them to get the energy would be from Russia. So let's see where they are. And let's also see once where they go with defense spending. It's one thing to say we're going to go from 1.3, 1.4 to 2% and do it right now. It's another to actually allocate the dollars and then find exactly the places where you're going to spend the money that actually makes a difference. So let's see once where they are in 6 to 9 months. Let's see where the rest of Europe is. You know, I'm skeptical.
I think you're right to be skeptical given their track record. But again, also it clearly will depend on where Russia is, whether it's still in Ukraine, whether it's still destroying that country. I think that this may become more and more untenable if that's the case. On the other hand, if the Russians do find some way to, you know, extricate themselves from Ukraine without breaking all of it, you know, it may be that your skepticism will be proven to be absolutely well-placed, then these Europeans will be backing away. What we need to do to help on the energy front is a topic for another day, but I think that's a very important issue for us either way, frankly. Pete, we have to take a short break. We're going to come right back with more with Congressman Hoekstra talking about the weaponization of our national security agencies against us and more right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, and we're continuing a very important conversation with a remarkable public servant, former Congressman, former Ambassador Pete Hoekstra, now the chairman of the Center for Security Policy's Board of Advisors. Pete, we were talking about challenges overseas. I want to talk to you about challenges here at home. One of the things that has been particularly worrying as we look at the job of protecting this country we love is, as you and I have visited about in the past, seems to be continuing to be a problem, namely the Biden administration's, well, weaponization of the intelligence community, over which you did oversight as a chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, and other national security agencies of our government. Talk a little bit, if you would, about how you see that at the moment and the implications of this kind of, well, use of entities that were supposed to be protecting us from enemies abroad against putative enemies here at home who seem to look a lot like us.
Well, I think it's been devastating to the intelligence community. You know, early on at the transition from Barack Obama to Donald Trump, we perhaps saw the greatest political scam that we've ever seen, which was the Russia hoax, fomented and brought forward by who? Sure, Hillary Clinton, an opponent to the president, but more importantly, facilitated and pushed by our intelligence community. James Clapper, John Brennan, Michael Hayden, James Comey. I mean, this is the core of our intelligence community and our law enforcement system. It was absolutely awful. And I think as Bill Barr came out, said in the last 48 hours, one of the biggest hoaxes that we'd ever seen in American politics. But it was pushed by the intelligence community, and they leaked information. They didn't do this, you know, in, you know, confidential briefings to Donald Trump or to Barack Obama. They leaked this information to the media to undercut an incoming administration, and they were successful, and they basically neutralized significantly hindered the effectiveness of Donald Trump's first 2 years in office because of what they did. They lose credibility, and then you go on. It doesn't stop. You know, they've proven to be incompetent in assessing the threats from China and Russia, as you mentioned, which is where they need to be focused on. So here they are. They're planning domestic shenanigans. And they're forgetting their core role, which is keeping America safe.
Yeah. One of the particularly worrying facets of this has been the extent to which the Department of Homeland Security, most especially, has been identifying as domestic terrorists, or potential domestic terrorists at least, people who have been expressing dissenting opinions on things like, well, the election results of the 2020 presidential race, or the COVID 19 related pronouncements of Tony Fauci and the like. This is deeply troubling, especially to the extent that it clearly is translating into an effort to restrict freedom of speech, don't you think?
Oh, no, it's very, very frightening. You know, Dr. Fauci, you know, the emails that came out, what he was involved in. And back in 2020, if you wanted to talk about this, not only were you canceled by the federal government, but you were also canceled by social media. We find out a year later, well, you know, there maybe should have been more questioning about this. There needs to be a lot of questioning about the 2020 election. You know, my home state of Michigan, of course, I was in the Netherlands at the time, but they send out, I think they sent out 7.7 million unsolicited absentee ballots. In Michigan, the process normally is, you know, if you're going to be absent on election day, you request a ballot from your local clerk, you get your ballot, you fill it out, and you return it. But, you know, many states bypassed that mechanism, and they went to totally uncharted waters by sending out ballots and just changing the mechanisms for voting. Zuckerberg spent, what, $400 million through a foundation, so it was tax-free dollars. The DNC spent about $424 million, and the Zuckerbucks went to communities where they significantly increased voter turnout. It so happens that most of those districts were Democrat districts. So, you know, we need to focus on what our strengths are, and America is strong enough to debate complicated issues without having the federal government or social media companies come in and tell us what's true and what's not. It's a scary path that we are starting to move down.
Indeed. On the Zuckerbucks caper, I understand that Dinesh D'Souza's got a new film coming out shortly in which he actually has video footage of so-called mules being used to stuff those boxes to gain the kind of result that you just talked about, Congressman, namely greater voter participation, as they say, in these districts that were, you know, clearly very much aligned.
I think there's Frank, there's two pieces coming out. The one by Dinesh D'Souza, which I believe is called 2000 Mules. And I've seen the trailer for it. I've seen a presentation on it. It's striking, the information that he's able to get and how he collects it and puts it together. There's also a film coming out on the Zuckerbucks.
Well, both are going to be needed, needless to say, and I hope will be a further disincentive to the kind of efforts to make permanent national law along the lines of the fraudulent actions that seem to have taken place in the last election cycle. I just also wanted very quickly to mention one other thing, Congressman. If you're concerned about the encroachment of, you know, the big government on our freedoms, I encourage you to go to stopvaxpassports.org, where we have an online facility for registering your opposition to it, especially with some Republican governors who seem to be intent on putting in a digital passport, a so-called digital health card. We don't want any part of that. Pete, we have to leave it at that. I'm afraid we're hard out of time. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Securing America. I hope you feel better equipped to do just that. And I hope you check us out at securingamerica.tv and then go forth and multiply.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.